Thank you. We'll call the next case, Morrish v. USA, 093953. Mr. Womack.
May it please the Court, I'm John Womack. You've heard a lot of complicated stuff this morning. This case, to me at least, seems to be relatively simple. The relative facts here are that Gerald Morrish started seeking diagnosis for his complaints, which we now know led to a stroke in May of 2003. He was diagnosed with this thing called Eagle Syndrome on May 19th. He was referred to an ENT on June 16th, who did found a cyst and aspirated it and tested it. Never got around to telling anybody what it said, but did that. Then on June 30th, the CAT scan was done, and atherosclerosis was found, and then nothing happened. Nothing. That doctor who did the CAT scan said need to do an ultrasound. Maybe there's some kind of problem with the carotid arteries. But nothing was done after that. And that's really my case.
Does the record show anything? I mean, there's a lot of discussion about proximate cause, but is there anything to relate all of the things that were found early, including the CAT scan, to the stroke?
No, but that's the point, Judge. There wasn't anything found. If we had a smoking gun, it'd be very simple. The carotid artery was totally blocked. They ignored it. He died. But the issue here. And where Dr. Riley's testimony, he was the government's expert, where his testimony is so clear, at least to this feeble mind, nothing was done. You've got the duty, the standard of care for physicians trying to treat a patient is to work the patient up. And you start with all these efforts to find stuff, and then you just totally, absolutely stop. Now, the key here, and what the trial judge focused on, was this event where Gerald had blindness in one eye and numbness in one side. Very specific findings that Dr. Riley said were important, indicated possible stroke. Betty Moore said she called and told somebody that. The judge didn't believe her. That's fine. He can make that decision. But what he doesn't do, I mean, we know that fact actually occurred. The guy really had blindness in one eye, numbness in the other. Strange, he couldn't have made that up if he wanted to. And that's a significant factor. So if anybody's following this patient, if anybody calls up and said, you need to go in for your ultrasound and ask for, as they always do, ask for a history, what's going on with you, what's happening to you now? You know, the judge focused on Betty Morse. She lied, I'm ruling against you. That's plain and simple. What he ignored was the law in Illinois creates a presumption that if you've got evidence or a witness, you've got to present them.
Her, though, is she claimed she made the call on the cell phone. Cell phone records didn't show it. Then, you know, no, that I was at home. There's no evidence presented there. And that what she relayed in that conversation was crucial as it relates to the probable cause.
Absolutely.
I mean, the proximate cause determination.
Absolutely, absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial. So is she contributory negligent? Is he contributory negligent? Who in the world has the duty to provide care to the patient, Judge? Who followed this man for 2 weeks? I'm sorry?
If that information is not reported, mm-hmm. How can that be responsible for the stroke?
Because there's a duty, Your Honor, a clear-cut, absolute duty to follow the patient. This guy was abandoned. Nobody told him about the ultrasound until after the stroke occurred. Nobody followed up with him. Nobody even, I mean, the man thinks he might have cancer, and nobody calls to tell him that the cancer tests were negative. That's not relevant, but it shows the care. But after, you've got this workup going on. We think he's got this. She does a CAT scan, and the CAT scan comes back showing atherosclerosis. And you need a follow-up to do the ultrasound. Nobody ever tells him. Nobody ever tells him he needs the ultrasound until after the stroke occurs. There's no contact. He's just dropped. He's abandoned by everybody. We can pick on Betty all day long. But Gerald had this condition, and if he'd been properly followed, he would have found that condition, and that's exactly what Riley said. I'm sorry. Jen, I'm sorry. I thought you had a question.
Well, what's the duty breach? The duty breach was the failure to call him and follow up fast enough. They called him eventually, right? How long? I mean, eventually they called him and told him he needed an ultrasound. It was just too late.
2 days after the stroke.
Okay, so how much time passed between the CAT scan and the stroke?
14 days.
Okay. number one, was there a duty to call him that quickly? That's number one. But even if there was a duty to call him that quickly, was anything seen in the CAT scan that would have predicted the stroke?
Yes, the atherosclerosis in the carotid arteries and the arteries of the heart. Not predict the stroke. I'm not sure you can predict the stroke. But there was there, Judge, there was more there that required more care. I mean, what you have here is treatment of things and not patients. We read a CAT scan, but we don't treat the entire patient. You take the aspirate. They know what didn't cause the problems he was having, but nobody ever followed with the patient, talked to the patient, and found out for the patient. I mean, there's no follow for this guy at all. 2 weeks is a lifetime in this case, and now he's going to suffer a lifetime because I know I understand exactly what you're saying. I understand the judge being upset with Betty and her lack of ability to understand what happened. I'm not sure she was lying. She may have been confused, but certainly she couldn't back up her testimony.
If she was confused and she called from the house, then that's why we have home records.
Well, Judge, where are the phone records from the government?
The phone records.
Where are the phone records from the government showing?
Wants to be believed.
I'm sorry?
She's the one that wants to be believed. Her credibility is at issue, and so providing the home phone records would have gone a long way to do that.
Well, they weren't available, Judge. We couldn't produce them.
Not by subpoena?
No, we tried.
What was the response?
We couldn't get those records. The phone companies have had 17 or 18 different mergers in the last several years. We couldn't get those records. And we can't argue that what's not in the record. I can't tell you that she's telling the truth.
And was that put before the court that you attempted to get those records and they were unavailable?
I'm sure it was. But I think
was it?
Judge, I don't know for sure. I think it was, but I'm not sure. But I know we didn't have proof.
She testified that she knew the identity of the person she spoke to on the phone, but yeah. I gather that person was never called?
No. We had his first name, not his last name. The government never called any fact witness.
But you could have. The government didn't have to do it. You could have done it.
The government doesn't have to do it. I could have done it, but if the government has them and controls them, a presumption is created. Presumption was created here that was never rebutted. Never overcome.
Presumption of what?
Presumption that they had evidence or witnesses or testimony that would have been to their benefit and didn't call. I don't.
So did you issue interrogatories trying to find out if anybody by that first name was working at the number that she called?
Yes, and we finally found the first name. We didn't call him. We could have. We didn't. There was never any. We asked for production. There was never any production in the record of any phone calls from the government to Betty Morse.
And there's nothing in any medical record reflecting that call.
I'm sorry, Judge. You're talking about the call about
the medical records reflecting that the calls took place.
You're talking about the calls from the VA to the doctor?
From Betty to the
medical. The answer is yes. There were no records showing that you made that phone call. And I can't overcome that fact, but everything gets lost on that fact. Let's assume the phone call was never made at all, which is the result of ignoring Betty's testimony. How does that exculpate the people who are supposed to provide care to this veteran who don't even tell him he needs an ultrasound?
And what evidence did you have that the failure of the VA to make the calls within those 14 days was below the standard?
The testimony by the government's expert, Dr. Riley.
And that it caused the stroke?
Well, no. You're talking about causing the stroke. I'm not sure anybody knows what causes a stroke. Lots of things cause it. The testimony was that if he had received appropriate care, appropriate follow-up, what happens in medical care is you go, they call you up, say you need an ultrasound, you go in to get the ultrasound, they take a history from you again. History would have indicated this unusual event that had happened to him. Plus, who knows what else it would have indicated. We know the man had a stroke. We know he had a endocarditectomy on the day of the stroke. We know his carotid artery was closed up. This nonsense about proximate cause because it happened inside the brain is pure nonsense because the plaque didn't come from inside the brain. That's how he got there. But we know if he had been followed and asked proper questions, then, and Dr. Riley missed that, that there would have been, they would have found what was going on and could have provided. I mean, he was never even put on blood thinners, for God's sake.
Are you trying to press any issue relating to Dr. Grubbs? You mentioned it in your brief. The other side doesn't respond. I don't think much of an argument was made. I mean, is that an issue you're abandoning or pressing?
Well, I would like for you to address it. The entire case was tainted Illinois has got a very clear-cut rule on ex parte contact with the doctor, the Patillo doctrine. It was completely, totally violated by the defense who defended the attorney who sued from a legal malpractice.
What would he have done for you if he had been called?
I would have asked. I don't call a witness who I don't have any idea what they're going to say. I don't call a witness who might hurt me after he's been contacted like that. I didn't call him just like a cross-examiner.
You didn't depose him.
His deposition was taken in the case, yes, and he testified about standard of care. I would have called him on the issue of causation and on what would have happened had there been a proper workup. And I was not allowed to do that because of Pat Murphy's a good friend of mine, but I think it was an outrageous decision on his part. Thank you.
Mr. Wyatt?
May it please the Court, I'm Nathan Wyatt for the United States in this case. First of all, I would point out that the Court has a real problem doing a meaningful review of Judge Murphy's decision following the bench trial in this case because the appellant has failed to provide the complete trial transcript as the appellant is required to do by Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 10b-2. The cases on that are cited in the government's brief at pages 8 and 9. It's hard to imagine how the court is going to get into a meaningful review of Judge Murphy's findings of fact and conclusions of law without a complete transcript of the bench trial. The plaintiff's opening brief relies primarily, as does his factual statement today, on allegations from the complaint unsupported by the record. Generally, what I would try to do in an oral argument is point the court to portions of the record that would be helpful in making your decision. For the most part, I can't do that because the court doesn't have the record of the bench trial. In response to Judge Gottschall's question about Dr. Grubbs,
was the full record of the bench trial transcribed?
It was not transcribed because the plaintiff did not request the full transcript be completed. With respect to Judge Gottschall's question about Dr. Grubbs, I point out that this Petrillo violation has nothing to do with this FTCA case or with the government. There was never any allegation that the government attorney made any Petrillo violation. Dr. Grubbs was someone who treated Mr. Morish after he was seen by the VA. At most, he would have been a damages witness against the government, or he might have given 702 opinion testimony. The plaintiff had an expert medical witness. He was not prejudiced in any way by not calling Dr. Grubbs. He was free to call Dr. Grubbs and never tried to do so. He never asked for separate trials or asked for the jury to be removed while Dr. Grubbs was being examined, all remedies that the court could have considered if the plaintiff had asked for them at the time. So that he waits until the appeal, and then he raises this Petrillo violation and suggests that he's somehow prejudiced in his case against the government because of the other defendant's Petrillo violation.
Your witness, Dr. Riley, I think did testify that the standard of care was breached if Mr. Morris was never notified of the results of the biopsy. Was he asked about the time frame at all? I mean, we're talking about a fairly short span of time here, and I'm wondering if he meant if he said whether he was talking about Mr. Morris never being notified or just not being notified within that time frame. Do you recall?
I think the question was posed in the context of the time frame.
Okay.
I don't recall, but I think the question was something like, if the VA didn't call by the time that he had the stroke, would that have been a violation of the standard of care? Dr. Riley conceded the VA should have followed up and given him the results of his CT scan. Dr. Riley also testified, however, that the CT scan of the neck was completely unrelated to the stroke, that the situs of the stroke was in Mr. Morris's brain, that further examination of the neck wouldn't have revealed that he was in imminent risk of a stroke, that the CT scan didn't show that he was in any danger of a stroke. The CT scan showed atherosclerotic changes of the carotid artery, which, according to Dr. Riley, didn't have anything to do with the stroke. In fact, if you had the complete transcript, you would see that even the plaintiff's own expert conceded that point. The plaintiff's whole case from the beginning was that Mr. Morris and his wife had made calls to the VA on June the 16th and June the 30th, reporting that Mr. Morris was having signs and symptoms of an impending stroke, that he was experiencing flashes of blindness and numbness on the left side. They were pinned down through written interrogatories, three sets of written interrogatories, and deposition questions about when did they make the calls, how did they make the calls. They testified repeatedly that they made the calls from the cell phones. Mr. Womack, in his argument, asked an interesting question. Where are the phone records from the government? Leading up to the trial, the government had every reason to believe that the plaintiff's testimony would be that they made calls from the cell phones. The government subpoenaed and presented the cell phone records. At trial, the plaintiffs began to shift their testimony, saying, well, maybe we actually called from home, maybe we used a calling card, to now ask, well, why didn't the government have those phone records also? We had no way to see that that testimony was coming. That was a shift in testimony at the trial at the last minute. And Judge Murphy made the very reasonable and obvious credibility decision that the plaintiffs weren't credible on that testimony at that point, when they had shifted their testimony from earlier sworn statements. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Back to this transcript issue, so you just decided as the government not to get a transcript as well. I mean, I understand it was his obligation to provide the transcript for the record, but you decided not to get it transcribed as well.
That's correct. I made that decision, Your Honor. I made that decision because we are not seeking review of Judge Murphy's findings of fact, and the government is perfectly satisfied to rely on Judge Murphy's findings of fact.
Thank you. I'll give you 1 minute.
I guess what I just want to try to emphasize again, what everybody focuses on Betty, and Betty's a liar, so we lose the case. But their testimony was incredible. Gerald's testimony about what happened to him was credible. And if anybody treating this man had ever bothered to call him and talk to him and follow up like they should have, we probably wouldn't be here today.
So, and I guess I'll get back to the transcript with you. Why didn't you order it?
I thought we had enough, Judge, to put the issues before you and to the trial judge. The case was a hugely convoluted case, legal malpractice and medical malpractice, and the cost of that entire transcript would have been extreme. We had enough here. If you look at Riley's own testimony, their own expert, I think it's enough to show what's going on. You've got an obligation to provide care, to follow the patient. He was abandoned.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.